I can't help but realize that a lot of the things that have happened in the downtown east side and with a lot of Aboriginal people is the impact of colonization.
For reasons beyond my understanding, the Canadian government needs to give permission for the United Nations to send representatives.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire was produced and hosted by Carly Forbes in the ward on occupied neutral territory. In this edition, we'll hear from Indigenous women on the West Coast about the Missing and Murdered Women's Inquiry. We'll also hear live audio from a rally for the missing and murdered women in Montreal. But first, here's the headlines.
A recent report released by BC's Attorney General is highly critical of the provincial government's handling of BC forests. Unlike private logging companies, the province is not required to reforest, and significant portions of BC's forests have been damaged by wildfire and pests. Attorney General John Doyle wrote that BC is failing to ensure a healthy forest industry with proper reforestation and lacks reliable information on the extent of the damage. Anthony Britniff is a retired forester, and he says there are over 2 million hectares of viable land that should be planted. The government says that it has only identified 733,000 hectares, though the province's Natural Resource Operations Minister says that number may grow. Reporting for Groundwire, I'm Joel Bard.
The case against Mohamed Zeki Majoub. This month, the lawyers of Torontonian Mohamed Zeki Majoub, a man who has been in jail or under house arrest for the last 11 and a half years, will appear in court to ask that all of the proceedings against him be tossed out. Mohamed Zeki Majoub came to Canada in 1995 from Egypt, where he had been detained without charge and tortured. In 1996, he was accepted as a refugee. He settled in Toronto, got married, and had two young sons. In June 2000, he was arrested under a security certificate. Since his arrest, he has spent years in prison and under house arrest without any charges being laid against him or having access to the evidence against him. Over the course of his prison time, starting in 2002, he held various hunger strikes to protest his prison conditions. In April 2006, Mr. Majoub, along with 300 men, were transferred to the Kingston Immigration Holding Center, known by many as Guantanamo North. During their prison time, him and two other inmates began a 93-day hunger strike. In 2007, the Supreme Court of Canada unanimously decided that security certificates were unconstitutional. Due to the use of secret evidence and secret trials, the security certificates process was deemed to be a violation of fundamental principles of justice. In February 2008, Mr. Majoub received new security certificates. He returned to Guantanamo North in 2008. In 2009, where he began another hunger strike along with four other men. On February 3, 2012, the federal court ruled that the government failed to show that it is reasonable to maintain intrusive conditions of control and surveillance on Mr. Majoub. For the first time since his arrest in 2000, Mr. Majoub does not live under surveillance imposed on him by security certificates. Despite this, other conditions remain, such as prohibition on the use of internet and cell phone, phone tapping, and supervision outside Toronto. Many organizations, like No One is Illegal Toronto and the People's Commission Network, are rallying together to oppose the measure of security certificates. They are also protesting the abuse of Mr. Majoub's rights during the years of 1999-2006 when CSIS and the Canadian Border Services Agency listened to and taped conversations between Mr. Majoub and his lawyers, violating the solicitor-client privilege. For more information on Majoub's trial and Canada's security certificates, go to noonesillegal.org. That's it for the headlines. Now it's time for our feature stories. First, we'll hear from Joel Bard at the Vancouver Alliance for the Arts.
The Alliance for Arts and Culture is located in a big two-story loft in downtown Vancouver. Posters of upcoming productions and events line the walls. and there's a revolving postcard holder where you can grab pamphlets on programs and workshops to support artists. I first read about the organization last week. The Alliance came out against the BC government's budget and said the province needs to do more to support the arts in BC. Kevin Dale McEwen is the Alliance's Director of Communications. I spoke to him in his office, tucked away in the back corner on the second floor. I began the interview by asking him about who the Alliance works with and what services it provides.
We're a member-based organization. We represent about 350 arts organizations and individual artists in the Greater Vancouver area. We work with anyone who is an active artist working in the community, an arts organization, whether they're professional arts organizations or community arts. Most of our members are incorporated societies. So we work on behalf of all of our membership on a number of different projects. Advocacy is one of the ongoing things that we do, helping to inform the general public and the government of the value of the arts and the case for the arts, so that there's a greater understanding of the impact in the community. Aside from that, we also produce workshops and conference activities. We provide a number of resources in our office and online, including an arts jobs board, access to information on grants and funding bodies, and we help to connect artists and arts organizations to the things that they need in order to build capacity.
The BC government released its annual budget on February 21st. It caps spending increases to 2% a year for the next 2 years. The budgets of a number of ministries will be cut. The budget for arts will be frozen. I asked Kevin why the Alliance is critical.
Well, our position on the budget is that we understand that the government is facing a lot of challenges, and most sectors in our economy are facing many economic challenges and so on. The arts sector is facing a lot of challenges. The government has, through various gestures over the last few months, made it very clear that they believe that the arts are an important economic driver, and that they believe that the arts are extremely valuable in our community. The budget for arts investment from the province, however, actually freezes those investments at the current levels for the next 3 years. And that's disappointing to us, working on behalf of building stronger arts, because British Columbia is actually, in all of Canada, the lowest investor per capita in the arts in Canada. So we were looking for some movement forward in that over time, that even just keeping up with inflation, an inflationary 2% increase every year to the British Columbia Arts Council, for example, would be a better step ahead than where we are right now, where each year is frozen and those organizations whose costs keep rising will actually be falling behind.
I ended our conversation by asking about what's happened since he spoke out against the budget on behalf of the Alliance, about how the public and government has reacted to what he said.
We've had a lot of encouraging comments from the public and from our members about our reminders to the government that if we're freezing the budget where it is right now, that we're not even caught up to where we have been in the past, and that the severe cuts that the art sector has faced have not been fully restored, let alone making any progress toward the standards set in other provinces. We have also had communication with the ministry since the budget came out and since we've issued our response, and that's been a positive dialogue, but one where there were several points on which we don't see eye to eye on the current situation, but we certainly have an agreement to continue a dialogue moving forward.
And now it's time for a short musical break. Oh, sure. was Ocean Blue by Ray Spoon from their new album, I Can't Keep All of Our Secrets. And now for an interview with Mona Woodward and Serenity Endo by Gnarchi O'Sullivan on When Spirit Whispers. This interview took place on February 13th, following a day in court for the inquiry for the missing and murdered Indigenous women in the downtown east side of Vancouver.
This morning, we just came from the inquiry, Serenity and I, and the mood was very somber, and all the gathering of the women, the family members, and the children was very heavily wrought with emotion today. And so Valentine's Day is also a day that we honor the lives of the missing and murdered women and their family. And today there was a good turnout at the corner of Georgia and Granville. And we all listened to the speakers, as well as we had our elders walking around with the medicines to help assist us to do the good work that we're doing in the community. And I can't help but realize that a lot of the things that have happened in the downtown east side and with a lot of Aboriginal people is the impact of colonization and the impact of the Indian residential schools. And in one way or form, we all are connected to that, of being a survivor of Indian residential schools, of oppression, of colonization, and the systemic oppression that happens within all of those institutions that are supposed to bring justice. But, you know, in my address to the people today, you know, there always seems to be two kinds of justice. And for First Nations Aboriginal women, there is no justice. And that is such a tragedy, because we really want to have those changes. And, you know, the whole world is looking on to what is happening in Vancouver, in the inquiry, in the sham, in the money that was designated to help out with the changes to the way that they address missing persons that are in the category of marginalized people and or people that are involved in the sex trade industry. So when we look at that, there's a lot of Aboriginal women, but there's also, on the other side, we have a lot of Aboriginal men as well. And Aboriginal Front Door has had in the past 3 months, I would say there's been two women and two men, two family members that have come in and talked about their grief, their loss, and the inaction that they feel denied. So I just wanted to hear from Serenity to see what she thought of the inquiry from a youth perspective.
I never realized how many youth were like how many women were missing until you actually seen the banner go along. Like, it went full circle from the corner of, like, you know when you just get off the SkyTrain just before the Canada Line? That we had that whole corner wrapped around in names, and some of the sheets had two pictures and some had four, and four different names. None of them were found. None of them were... It was very devastating. I almost cried a little. My heart got really heavy about everything. And it was very devastating. And seeing the women crying because they're missing their mom or their sister, their grandmother, and they haven't been found. There's one lady that hasn't been found since 1996. She went missing, and the cops didn't even try and find her. And hearing her children speak really kind of it touched my heart deeply. But on a positive note, I seen a little girl. Her name's Serenity, too, but she's just outgoing. She's 5 years old, and she was really into everything. But she was affected too by it, because her mom's best friend went missing not too long ago, which was pretty devastating. It was touching.
Following the inquiry that day, there was a rally in Vancouver's downtown east side for the missing and murdered Indigenous women. Laura Holland from the Aboriginal Women's Action Network spoke about the inquiry and the missing justice and the murdered women. This video was provided by Lauren Emily Oxford and the Vancouver Media Co-op.
I volunteer and organize with a group of women, the Aboriginal Women's Action Network, and we believe there cannot be a meaningful outcome from the OPAL Commission in light of the fact that the Native Court Workers and Counseling Association of BC, the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, the Carrier Sicani, NWAC, Power of Women Group, many other groups have been shut out of this process.
And now we'll hear a final word from Gennargi O'Sullivan about the inquiry.
If you go into the inquiry, you'll just see a sea of lawyers who are representing, you know, the police, right? And we only have two lawyers that I know of who are representing the First People.
Our next feature is audio from a live broadcast of a rally and march for the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Montreal.
Here she comes. So now, Ellen Gabriel.
My name is Ellen Gabriel. I'm from the Mohawk community of Ganasadage. And for those of you who are just newcomers to this area, welcome to Mohawk territory. It's an honor to be asked to speak here on this very important day to commemorate the lives of the women who have been lost, Aboriginal women who have been lost through this phenomenon and travesty that we see in Canada of murdered and missing Aboriginal women. And the apathetic attitude of the Canadian government regarding this issue. What has happened in the past? We have gone through so many inquiries, we have gone through so many testimonials as Aboriginal women's organizations, as witnesses of communities, to know what we need to do to stop this from happening. Amnesty International stated in their Stolen Sisters report that the root causes of what is going on, the violence against Aboriginal women, is rooted in colonialism. Stephen Harper, a few years ago at a G8 summit, said that there was no colonization in Canada. So what can you expect from a prime minister who remains ignorant, disrespects the human rights and the dignity of Aboriginal women and their children and their families? What can you expect? We need to put pressure on this government, a government that seems not to, to be easily shamed. The Native Women's Association of Canada have on their website a letter that you can send to the government of Canada to urge them to participate peacefully in an international inquiry. An international inquiry that they are legally obliged to participate in because of the optional protocol they have in CETA. It's important that people are aware of this. It's important that each and every one of you see yourselves as seeds of knowledge to pass it on what is going on and what has been going on against Aboriginal women in Canada. For over 100 years, we have been devalued. Our rights have not been respected. And so certain members of Canadian society have felt that they can do what they like to Aboriginal women with impunity. The RCMP are some of the biggest culprits of not taking this issue seriously. And yet the government of Canada diverted the funds for the research for Sisters in Spirit to these very authorities who have done nothing. It's 2012. It's time to stop the ignorance, the apathy, and the disrespect that Indigenous women and their families and their communities have had to face because of colonization. Colonization is one of the biggest culprits to why we see such a big number of Aboriginal women being killed in Canada. The United Nations inquiry has to go on. We need your support to make this a reality. And let's move this government and shame them into participating into this inquiry, because justice is long overdue for Aboriginal women and their children. So thank you very much. Nyokoa.
And now we'll hear from Maya from Justice for Missing and Murdered Native Women.
So the Feminist Alliance for International Action and the Native Women's Association of Canada have been pushing the United Nations, specifically the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, to actually conduct an investigation into what's been going on here in Canada with regards to this issue. And they successfully got their attention recently. And what's happening now is that the United Nations, it was circulated around the media for quite a while that they were in fact going to send representatives to Canada to investigate. But now it seems that they're not actually, that was false information. They are actually just considering it. So we really want to let people know about this and encourage them to pressure not only the United Nations to go forth with this and put as much of a spotlight on the Canadian government and on this issue as possible, but we also want to pressure the government to cooperate with it, because for reasons beyond my understanding, the Canadian government needs to give permission for the United Nations to send representatives.
And that does it for this special edition of Off the Hour and Night of Solidarity News, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective and Blueprint Radio. My name is Verena. I have been your host. Your engineer was Takuro. Your hosts at the remote broadcast were Portia, Risa, Caitlin, Renee, and Sarah from the Blueprint Radio Collective. Special thanks to our news coordinator, Courtney, and our CQT's awesome IT geek, Isaac, for setting up the remote broadcast. Shout out to our supporters at the Status of Women Canada and the Girls Action Foundation.
And now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Tara Lansley sat down with Frieda Worden from WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service, to talk about WINGS, Women in Radio, and International Women's Day.
Station of CJSF in Burnaby, British Columbia. What was the initial reaction when you started? Did you receive a lot of support?
Actually, no. We received a lot of discouragement from quite a lot of people. In fact, I got fired from my job. we didn't get a lot of support, but we did find a lot of women around the world. I mean, think about this. It was 1986. We had no internet. We had no email. There was barely postal service in some countries. And we had a list that we had acquired from the United Nations World Conference on Women that had taken place in Nairobi, Kenya, in 1985. That list was women radio producers who had been there. And we took that list and we wrote letters to all the women. And we said, would you like to submit something for this newscast? We did get some funding to do a pilot initially. And they started sending things in, but it took a long time. It could take months. And even after we did the first show, we got a piece of tape from the Soviet Union that we had asked for like 3 months before. And we said, oh my gosh, we can't just not use this. We've gone to so much trouble. So even though we didn't get any more funding, we just went ahead and produced another episode anyway. And we made a decision that we would keep producing this show as long as we could, whether we had funding or not. Mm-hmm. And it was hard. There was a lot of resistance to it. One of the reasons being that it was really community radio, and we were trying to market it in a public radio context. And people said, oh, well, you know, women, that's very minority interest. This is very marginal. The decade for women is over. These issues should be finished, you know. But, of course, they weren't finished. And those were the kind of things that we had to face up to. What really helped me was discovering community radio stations that weren't just looking for national public radio news in the U.S. or, you know, things kind of like the CBC here, except they're more independent, those stations. And finding community radio people who wanted to hear diversity of voices. And also, in 1986, I got to go to the second conference of AMARC, the first big conference of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, that was in Vancouver. And I met Canadian community radio broadcasters, and they were actually very encouraging. compared to to the U.S. one, people that I had met, and also met community radio broadcasters from other countries. One of the women I met, Margareta Darcy, is still a friend of mine today. She does a pirate radio station in Galway, Ireland.
How did you manage to make such a significant organization the way you have?
I mean, we say it's a big organization, but it's really just produced out of my living room. But with the networking, and I thank heaven for the internet and for email and for FTP and those things, because even in India or Pakistan, places like that, I mean, people are able to file their stories through the internet, which means we get them faster. They're able to edit their own work, usually, at home. I mean, it's so... If it hadn't been for the timing that we grew up with email and the internet, I think it would have been much harder to maintain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you get to hear such a diversity of voices as well as a result.
Yeah. For me, Wings has been such an education.
For more information on the Women's International News Gathering Service, to find a station near you that features Wings, as well as podcasts and ways to support or contribute, you can visit www.wings.org, or you can find them on the NCRA Program Exchange. And for more information on the International Women's Day and events in your area, you can visit www.internationalwomensday.com.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. I'm Carly Forbes. Thanks for tuning in. Music this week was by Ray Spoon. Headlines this week were written by Leanne Arneson and Joel Bard. We also thank Gennardi O'Sullivan, the Vancouver Media Co-op, Off the Hour at CKUT, and Lauren Emily Oxford. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download it at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.